Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We are about to have a conversation with one person has been here a lot. One person has been on my show for a long time. Anthony McCarthy is to my right, of course, hosts the Anthony McCarthy Show, every Friday here on WEA from 5 to 7 p.m. And Fern Shen, who publishes, edits, is the publisher and editor and founder of the Baltimore Brew, an online newspaper that does more reporting with a staff of 2.0 than most people do with a staff of
much more.
We're looking to be 3.0 one of these days.
That's
Mark.
Good.
That's right.
3.0.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
Good
Thanks.
To have you here. And we're going to talk about all manner of things, but one of the first things we're going to do is have a conversation with Congressman Roscoe Bartlett, who joins us by phone. He's a Republican, represents the Maryland 6th District in the House of Representatives. He was redistricted. So to try to push him out and push somebody else in. We'll talk to him about that and the court case coming up. But we also want to talk to him about the Defense Reinvestment Act that he voted for. Only three of our local congressmen voted for it. Five voted against. Because maybe they think it's a stab at our civil liberties. And for somebody who's a libertarian, we want to find out why he voted for that bill and more. You can ask any question you'd like. Our listeners can join in at 410-319-8888. And Roscoe Bartlett, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Happy to be on. Thank you.
So I guess the first place to start, and please jump in, my fellow colleagues here, into the conversation, is the bill, which we've talked a little bit about on the air here and that I've been reading pretty thoroughly. And I was not shocked by the other two people who voted for the bill, but I was actually pretty shocked that you voted for the bill.
Well,
Which allows for internment of civilians in the United States government without a trial.
Well, there's a lot of misunderstanding about what's in our bill. I have huge problems with this detention thing. But most of that is not in our bill. We're not the Judiciary Committee. We're the Armed Services Committee. What was in our bill was that when someone is caught overseas, that they go into a military prison, that they're tried in a military court. This bill specifically, and this happened at the end, so most people really didn't know that. But at the end, this totally excluded U.S. citizens. They are not a part of what's in this NDAA bill, National Defense Authorization bill. They're just not in there. I have problems with the Patriot Act. I have problems with designating somebody as inimical to the national security interests of the country, and then we can take a citizen and put them in jail forever and charge them with nothing. They've not been to court. It's only an allegation. They've had no opportunity to face their accusers. They've not had the benefit of counsel, none of this. I have a huge problem with that. But this wasn't in this bill. What was in this bill was, as I stated, you know, that if they're caught on the battlefield overseas, the battlefield now is anywhere and everywhere, but this does not, it specifically exempted U.S. citizens.
Well, when I read Section 1031, it didn't exempt our citizens.
There is a specific, this was added very late, but I hope that it said notwithstanding anything else in the bill.
One of the reasons that some of the other congressmen decided to vote against it was because it could inter American citizens, which is why Congressman Sarbanes and Senator Cardin and your fellow Republican, Andy Harris, voted against it.
There's some language I was just looking at. I think this goes to what you're talking about. This is Fern Shen here. Hi, Congressman. It says, nothing in this section shall be construed to affect existing law or authorities relating to the detention of United States citizens, lawful resident aliens of the United States, or any other persons who are captured or arrested in the United States. So that last phrase, I mean, I was just, this is basically Americans on American soil could potentially be detained. But
added later was a specific thing that said that this exempted all U.S. citizens. And this was added later.
What?
And there may be some internal inconsistencies. This frequently happens when bills are changed at the last minute so they can be brought back to the floor. But I hope that the language in this exempting U.S. citizens preempted any other language. That was what we were told. You know, this was hammered out in the Senate, and it's the reason that the president. You know, I just felt that it was really interesting that the president and Democrats were more interested in protecting constitutional rights than Republicans. What's happened here?
Well, what is happening here? Senator Mark Udall.
My understanding that U.S. citizens were exempted.
I don't think they were. I mean, Senator Mark Udall, amendment.
That's what we were told, and that's why I voted for it. I'm not a lawyer. But this is what we were told, and this is why I voted for it. Because I was told that this, and it was added at the last minute. There may be some inconsistencies in it. But if you read further, you will find that all U.S. citizens are exempted from anything in this bill.
Well, I'm saying, I'm looking here, reading it now, it doesn't say that at all.
It does. It is in there. That language, and I don't know where it's added, but it is in the bill. I saw it in the bill. I was assured it was in the bill. It's the only reason the president signed the bill.
I wonder why. What's your thought, Congressman, about why the head of the FBI and Secretary of State, why so many sort of high officials in the administration are very disturbed by this bill?
Well, I think that most of that was before this phrase was added that exempted U.S. citizens.
Congressman, this is Anthony McCarthy.
Yeah.
I'm very curious about your thoughts as I was reading, and it could be that the language of the bill has changed and some of the versions we're reading.
This was added. Fine.
Yeah, may not have
come to it. Yeah, but this was added in the bill that it exempts all U.S. citizens.
Well, I'm desperately looking through the internet to try to find that. I'm not finding it.
I'm curious at your thoughts on what some people are very concerned about, which is the power of the executive, the power of the president, to decide the jurisdiction, whether it'll be civilian court or it would be military court, when it came to some of these, I'm not sure how we clarify or classify these combatants against the United States. Were you comfortable with the president having that much sweeping power?
No, I'm not comfortable at all with that. You know, how can the president look at a person and say they're a combatant against the United States? They've not been in court. They've not had a trial. You know, they've not had the opportunity to have defense. They've not been able to face their accusers. No, I'm not at all happy with that. I wasn't happy with it under Bush. I'm not happy with it under this president. You can't know how much I liked Ronald Reagan. I would have not been happy with this under Ronald Reagan. No, I'm not at all happy with that. And my colleagues say whatever it takes, you know, and what they tell you is that we will give up our freedom to get security. And I quote what Churchill said, if you will give up your freedom to get security, at the end of the day, you will have neither freedom nor security. You can't start down that slippery slope, and that's what they're doing. And I've had people call me and tell me, Congressman, you can take away some of my civil liberties if it'll help you catch these terrorists. You know, I say, bite your tongue. You don't know what you're saying. The biggest, a bigger threat to our form of government than these terrorists out there is the fact that we may degrade our civil liberties and rationalize it that we need to do that to defeat these terrorists. Benjamin Franklin, when he was asked, what have you given us, Mr. Franklin, he said, a republic, and I think it was a woman, a republic, madam, if you can keep it. And I think that he was probably more concerned about threats from within to this republic than threats from without. There were two big oceans separating us from anybody, and just sailing ships. I'm not sure he was at all much concerned about threats from outside. I think he was primarily concerned about threats from inside.
Did you want to say something, Anthony?
Well, it sounds like this bill is causing the very problems you're describing. I guess I don't understand why you voted for it. It's going to strip the FBI, federal prosecutors, and the courts of their powers to arrest and prosecute terrorists and hand it to the military. I would think somebody like you would go, whoa.
This bill exempted U.S. citizens. By the way, I have a problem with treating, and it was a tough vote for me, a really tough vote for me. I was a very senior member of the Defense Committee, and I need to support what we do because I'm a part of what we do. But I have a real problem with this, you know. I just think that this is I voted against the Patriot Act every time except the first time. What are you going to do? A few days after 9/11, you have a Patriot Act out there. Almost immediately, I started telling my constituents of them that the least patriotic thing I'd done since I came to Congress is to vote for the Patriot Act. And most of the people on my side, they'll argue that we need to do this because we're catching terrorists with it, you know. You know, I think that the biggest threat to the survival of this republic is not from without. I think it is from within if we degrade these civil liberties. You know, I ask myself, we're one person out of 22, and we have a fourth of all the good things in the world. We're a fourth of the world's economy. I ask myself, how come? Is it because we're the hardest working people in the world? I don't think you'd have trouble making that claim anymore, wouldn't you? Do we have the most respect for technical education? This year, the Chinese will graduate 7 times as many engineers as we graduate. Do we have the most respect for the nuclear family? This year, almost half our kids are born out of wedlock. What is it, then, that makes us so darned lucky that this one person out of 22 has a fourth of all the good things in the world? I think it's the milieu, that the climate that has been produced by our enormous respect for civil liberties. No other constitution, no other Bill of Rights comes even close to ours. I think we put at risk who we are as a premier economic and military power in the world if we permit any degradation of these civil liberties. So if I'm going to err, it's going to be on the side of protecting these civil liberties. I know most of the people on my side of the aisle aren't there, and they tell me whatever it takes.
Let us. I know you. We want to raise some other issues here, and we'll talk back to this. There is a court case going tomorrow that affects the redistricting of the state of Maryland, and your district and you were particularly targeted in this last redistricting of the state of Maryland.
Yes.
Do you plan to run again?
Yes. Oh yes, I'm running again. I'm very aggressively raising money. Unfortunately, my campaign manager was raising money because I didn't need much money in an R+13 district, and I had enough in the bank. We didn't raise anything this cycle to win this in this cycle. But we haven't raised any money for 6 months, so we're now very aggressively raising money, and I think we're about $150,000 now committed. It may not all come in. We hope to have another $100,000 before the end of the year so that we can show something very meaningful in this fourth quarter. But my chief of staff apparently thought that I should or would retire or something, and he was kind of promoting himself for this job and didn't raise any money. And there was some very unfortunate press that was engendered by that, and he recognized that he could no longer be effective in serving me, either me or the constituents, so he tendered his resignation, and I regretfully accepted it because, you know, we've been friends for 30 years. He's still my friend, and this is just too bad this happened. So, yes, we're running. We're very aggressively running. A number of people called me and told me that that if I didn't run, we were going to lose this seat for sure in this new district. I have some positions that are not unattractive to Democrats. As a matter of fact, we ran a recent poll. I got 22% of the Democrat vote in that poll. It was a big poll, like 1,800 people in the poll, and I got 22% of the Democrat vote. And they don't even know me in Montgomery County yet. I would think I'd get some more Democrat vote in Montgomery County once they get acquainted with me.
Congressman, let me ask you. I think a lot of people are curious as we watch this process move along and ultimately the plan went before the legislature. I am very curious at what your conversation was like when you sat down with the governor to discuss, because I think if we all view this as an objective observer, we don't like to say, well, this is blatantly political.
Of course, whether it's
Democrats or Republicans in charge, they often go after the other party. What was your conversation? What was the substance of your conversation with the governor as he told you what he planned to do with your district?
I told him that I didn't think that he would want to run for some higher office like a president with having dissed the minorities, that we had a great plan for him that had 3 minority districts in it that concentrated Hispanics in one of those minority districts so that their vote wasn't splintered. And he expressed considerable interest in our plan, but, you know, the plan that he ultimately supported was not his plan, although he had to endorse it. It was a plan put together by the 2 leading people in the House of Delegates in the Senate, you know, and it was the Democrats control redistricting in only 6 states. The Republicans probably in 4 times that many states. So they have few opportunities to pick up seats by redistricting, and this was one. And so they took advantage of an opportunity to pick up a seat. I don't think they're going to pick up the seat. We just had a poll out that says that the district is not the R4 district they thought it was. When we asked the generic poll question, if all you knew about the contenders for the 6th district congressional seat was that one was Republican, the other was a Democrat, how would you vote? And that was dead even at 37 plus a couple points for each one of the Republican and the Democrat. Obama in this poll had a 38% favorable rating plus 50% unfavorable rating. He loses to a generic Republican by 3 or 4 points. When they polled me against Garagiola, the
State senator.
State senator.
State senate. You know, I'm up by 9 points in that.
But well, without, I mean, when you take the statistical arguments aside, because everybody's got polls,
yep.
But I mean, it seems to me the larger issue here is whether you're in a state that is run by the Democratic Party or the Republican Party.
Oh, clearly, it's going to be for a very long time. You know, we have.
No, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is the process seems to be the problem. That we make redistricting a political issue, where some states like Iowa, New Mexico, and California are attempting to make it just a demographic issue,
proportional,
and they just do it without politics involved. I mean, that's the problem. We're making a political game of it.
Oh, they are indeed, and we will be a Democrat state for a very long time. We have two major. Kind of a smallish state with two major metropolitan areas: suburban Washington D.C. and Baltimore. And if you look at a map of across the United States where the red and blue is, you'll see the blue is concentrated in cities, and boy, we have two big ones. So for a small state, that's a pretty heavy burden, and we see it in a lot of things. We see it in mass transit. We see it in a lot of things. But you know, we're going to be a blue state for a very long time.
So let me do this. Let me make it before you have to run, Congressman Bartlett. Let me get a caller in here who wants to ask a question. 410-319-8888. Danielle in Reisterstown, you're on the air.
Yes. From earlier from the conversations, when you guys, as far as addressing civil liberties, I don't think people should vote, in essence, out of fear and panicking. And I think that would be one way to educate some of your voters and constituents. You know, I will have to agree to disagree on your vote, but I do feel that we should not give up our liberties out
thank
of fear
you.
Of panicking.
Thank
I'm not
you
minimizing
much.
9/11 or any of the events.
Yeah, no, you're exactly
fire.
Right. You know, if you do that, they will have won. You know, that's what they want. If we do that, they will have won. You know, I don't want them to win, which is, and if I, you know, if what I was told was not correct, but I saw it, I saw a lot of things. These are down on the Hill things. They aren't out in America, across America. That it was changed at the last minute. It's the reason the president signed it, and they exempted all U.S. citizens from this.
Congressman, can I ask you, before we have to go, I do want to ask you, the Republican field for the nomination to, I guess, be the standard bearer for your party has gotten more and more interesting with Newt Gingrich surging. Now we see that some poll shows that he's starting to plummet in Iowa, which I think was interesting because he was expected to, if he took those first couple of states, it would really impact Romney's opportunity to win the nomination. I think people think he is the presumptive nominee. But could you tell me, who are you supporting of the candidates that are in the race right now? Have you chosen a candidate that you think would be the best standard bearer for the Republican Party?
No, I have not. I'm very good friends with Ron Paul. He is quite misunderstood. He is not an isolationist. He is more of a free trader than I am. He's a non-interventionist. I know that it's easy to interpret a non-interventionist as an isolationist. He certainly is not an isolationist. He votes for free trade more often than I do. So he's a very good friend of mine. And, you know, Newt Gingrich, Newt has been in my office several times. As a matter of fact, he asked me if I would be a consultant on his campaign for EMP, which you've heard him mention, nuclear EMP, and EMP produced by solar flares and so forth. And I served under Newt. I came here in 92. I was in the minority 2 years before we came in the majority. And Newt is a very bright person. That's obvious in the debate. You know, he had some management defects. I'm sure that he's the first one to recognize those, and he's a different person today. I'm a different person today than I was 18 years ago. And
so
I'm
am I, I hope.
Would you be comfortable, Congressman, with Mitt Romney being the nominee of your party?
You know, I'm going to tell you what Newt tells the people there. You know, he looks across that group. He said, any one of us would make a better president than the guy that's in there. And another thing that recommends Newt to me, although I've not signed on to anybody yet, recommends Newt to me, is he has refused to break Reagan's 11th commandment and criticize others. Now, he has defended himself, but he has never taken the initiative to criticize the other people running. And he is right. Any one of them would make a better president than the guy that's in there. So let's just, you know, present us, you know, who I am, to the American public, and let them make the decision. You know, you don't build yourself up by tearing the other guy down. And I'm sick and tired of elections where at the end of the election cycle, the voters have two choices. They're going to vote for a dirty, rotten skunk or a really dirty rotten skunk. And I'm not sure that's what voters want at the end of the day.
Congressman Roscoe Bartlett, you need to make a visit here more often. It's always a pleasure to have you on the air with us.
I'm delighted to. Just invite me. I'm not a party crasher. You invite me and I will come.
All right. Great. Love to have you on here. Thank you so much. Roscoe Bartlett is the 6th District Congressman in the state of Maryland. Can I ask, and the line's open at 410-319-8888. Let me ask you guys a question. You know, we're on the show live this week, and then we're going to bring you all these wonderful new shows next week, but they're all pre-recorded because we're going to take a little break between Christmas and New Year's. And
that time of year.
Time to everybody take a chill and enjoy their families and,
yes,
and sit back for just a minute,
mm-hmm,
and not get into newspapers and cell phones. And so, but I have to ask you, what for you locally and or nationally were the most important stories of the year? What do you think that we should really be wrestling with as we end this year?
Oh, I think the Occupy thing, it's maybe to use that way of describing that issue is sort of smaller than it is. I mean, the whole issue of inequality and the banking system in our country, and is the economy broken or not? Were we had? People kind of think we were, and that upswelling of anger was fascinating, and it was national and it was local, and there were local versions of it that we covered in Baltimore Brew, and that really tied into the sort of current of dissatisfaction and real resentment. So that issue really resonated for me.
I agree about Baltimore. I mean, Occupy Baltimore. I think I'm on the other side of that. We've had this conversation, Mark. I'm not sure if in this city the occupiers had the impact that they have had in other cities, but have raised critical questions. I'm just not sure, and I'm disappointed, actually, at the level of organization and presentation by the Occupy Baltimore. I don't want to say leadership because they don't have leaders, but the folks who were involved. But I would tell you, Mark, in this full disclosure, you know, I was involved in the mayor's race. I think that the election for mayor of the city of Baltimore was so disappointing, not in the outcome or the choice made by the voters, but by the lack of participation, by the lack of real serious answers and solutions to problems that plague a great city. But we find ourselves continuing to lose population. We find crime in the city creeping up in a very dangerous, horrible way. And a lot of the economic development decisions that were made by this administration that was elected, but certainly had the support of a majority of the voters who came out, whether we're talking about the Grand Prix or whether we're talking about ways to get a business stimulated in this city, or whether or not we're talking about dealing with poverty in the city of Baltimore, there's a real lack of engagement by the elected class of our city. And unfortunately, the folks who make that decision, the voters, decided to check out.
Well, they were very dispirited. You know, I mean, I try to look at the glass being half full on that one. I mean, people were really had kind of thrown in the towel on government. And yet, I guess that's why, you know, it's my nature. I'm looking for the upside, the full part of the glass. And it was people piping up and talking about these issues, talking about the BDC, talking, you know, in our website, the Baltimore Brew, and elsewhere about, does this sort of trickle-down approach to how to save our city, is that really a strategy that's going to work for us? And people are starting to really question it. And so just hearing people pipe up about that, you know, during the election, it didn't make a difference as far as, you know, what's changing the status quo of the administration. But it did start a conversation that I think has, you know, resonated and is still having some impact.
And I get excited, Mark, when I read things like the Baltimore Brew that gives us such detailed the dynamics of not just politics, but of city life of this great city. And I listen to your program, and I try to duplicate and do the same thing on my program, where you actually allow the citizens to engage and ask the hard questions and not try to drive that, but really try to force the decision makers to be a part of that conversation. I am dispirited. I am heartbroken by the level of suffering that's taking place in this city. And I'm a part of it. I'm unemployed and, you know, a whole lot of other things. But it is very, very And it's happening all across the country. So I don't want to just say Baltimore is the, but I am dispirited also by a lack of solutions and a lack of engagement. I watched the city council in their first council meeting, and as excited as I was that two new members, young members, were joining the political class of our city council, I kind of shook my head because it is one of the most non-engaging groups of elected officials you have ever witnessed. They just don't seem to. I don't know, but I believe Baltimore is in trouble. And maybe I am growing cynical and I can't look at the glass as half full and I'm looking at it as half empty. Until I see people really start, including myself, because it starts with all of us, but see us really pushing the ball or the rock uphill at finding solutions for our children, for our future. I think that this year was very a tough year. To be in the city of Baltimore.
We're going to take a brief break. I want people to join us. The thoughts you just heard from Anthony McCarthy and Fern Shen, 410-319-8888. Your thoughts on what the most important story, what important issues we're facing this year are, whether it's in the city or nationally. I want to talk a little bit about when we come back the new report that's saying one out of two Americans is either in poverty or struggling to survive. One out of two. 410-319-8888. And I didn't ask Roscoe Bartlett. I meant to ask, but I didn't ask him.
What?
Which was why the Republicans decided to kill the extension for 2 months.
Payroll tax.
Payroll tax in America.
Right. That's right.
And what?
How do we let him get away without answering that?
Well, he'll answer it next time. 410-319-8888. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not a bank. It belongs to you. Money comes back to you. For more information, www.mecu.com. Fern Shen is with us. She hasn't been here in a while, but she's back in the studio. Publisher and editor of the Baltimore Brew and founder of the Baltimore Brew, Baltimore's online newspaper that does a lot of incredibly powerful journalistic work in our town, filling the gap. Anthony McCarthy, host of the Anthony McCarthy Show. Can I say that again? Host of the Anthony McCarthy Show every Friday on WEA from 5 to 7 p.m. 410-319-8888.
You talk so fast. Sometimes you're just going to must meet yourself coming around the other side of the block, Steiner.
And you know one real quick thing, Mark, I just want to say before we go to these callers and continue our conversation. As a journalist, as a media personality, I think it's very important that we lift up great journalism. And the Baltimore Brew, if you go to their website, you will get that kind of journalism that we're looking for everywhere, but you get it on that website. So I hope
Thank
that people you. Reach out and support you because we need you around for a very, very
Thank
long time.
Thank you, Anthony. Yeah, we have a Kickstarter campaign
right
now. We're trying to raise some money to keep doing what we do. We've been doing it on a shoestring, basically, just sort of out of our love for journalism and kind of crazy inability to stop reporting on stuff. We can't stop, but we need help. So take a look. There's a green button you can click on there to read about, you know, what we're up to.
It's important. You go to the site. It's really good. If you go to the Sun website, and I do go every day, read it every day, as I do the Brew, the first thing you see is sports. It's a big Ravens thing that pops up. And that, you know, it's fun. Who doesn't like football? Well, some people don't. But when you read The Brew, it's in other places, and other journals are trying to do things around the country like The Brew. It's going to the news that affects the people of the community and trying to really unearth it. And two things on the way to the phones here. We were talking during the break about Occupy Baltimore. And one of the things I said was of the 40 people who were moved out, 23 said, take me to a homeless shelter. And another majority of the 17 left were homeless, but they decided not to go to a homeless shelter. And the homeless people, one of the things the Occupy movement found in America is it came face to face with the harshest realities of urban poverty. And homeless people came to Occupy for lots of reasons, got political reasons on one level, but for the most part, it's because it was a place to get a hot meal, to live in safety. And it's what we're facing here in America now. One out of two people in America living in poverty or are in a tough, really tough financial situation. 55% African-American families. 55% of African-American families are now living in poverty in America, which is just completely stunning. 17% of white families are below the official poverty line. I mean, it's these numbers are astounding.
And we, you know, in Baltimore, we are a case in point. And it's so strange how people, it just becomes a problem hiding in plain sight that people become so inured to, so used to. And so, you know, it's been kind of fascinating at The Brew just listening to people and showing up and suddenly being able to sort of stop and say, you know, wow, the level of this problem is really huge. And, you know, here are some real people experiencing. I mean, Mark rides his bicycle around town and, you know, runs into one problem after another of these communities that really have felt forgotten. And, you know, it's sort of staggering. It just feels like we're scratching the surface.
And Mark, at Thanksgiving, I went up to I Can't Weekend and helped serve meals.
You worked for a long time.
Yeah, the clients as well as the community. I was at story after story, heartbreaking stories, human stories of families that came in who said that they were turned away at other shelters. And they were told, because they could not feed the masses.
Right.
Mm. And they were told, go up to Park Heights. You should be able to get some. It is, and it's across the country, but it's particularly painful to watch in a city that I know we all believe in and we all are a part of. And I lost a dear friend who committed suicide because of the financial burden that he felt like he was had become on his partner, and it was just devastated that family, all about repossessed cars, all about being evicted from an apartment. And we find ourselves in a very, very difficult time, and a very difficult conversation in this presidential election has to take place.
And we're going to be next Wednesday night, this coming Wednesday night, we'll be reading it's Homeless People's Memorial Day.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Mm-hmm. And I'll have folks on my show to talk about that. We'll be reading the names of 115 people who died homeless in Baltimore City streets this year. 115 people died homeless in Baltimore City.
It's unbelievable.
And unacceptable.
And unacceptable to see beds, not benches, people, you know, weren't able to make that simple statement about, you know, our neighbors who don't have a place to sleep. And that was just kind of stunning.
Let's go to the phone and see what people think as their issues of the day. Maybe comment on some of the things we've talked about here. 410-319-8888 is the number. And Iris and Waverly, you're on the air.
Hello, all. How are you?
Hi, Iris. Welcome.
It's really not fair of you to continue to give me things to talk about when you're only going to give me a little bit of time to talk.
Sorry, Iris.
Talk fast. Go to it.
Be like me. Talk fast, right?
I want to echo both Anthony and Mark in saying that The Brew has been a real, real blessing for Baltimore. I've been really happy to have another good, conscientious, alternative news source to turn to and to turn my students on to. I teach a public high school in East Baltimore.
Thank you.
Want to say that as a member of Occupy Baltimore, as somebody who's been involved since the get-go, I'm sorry to hear that we have disappointed you, Anthony, but I think that your judgment is premature. The movement is a marathon and not a sprint, and 2.5 months is a long time only for a child,
mm-hmm.
and we're really only getting started. And the fact that we didn't have, you know, tear gassing and baton wounds is partly because we have been respectful and partly because Baltimore is a giant that is slow to awaken. And partly, I got to say, and you may never hear me say this again, partly because the Baltimore City Police were really on board and respectful. I wish that they treated my teenagers as well as they treated Occupy Baltimore. But there's been a lot of the kind of progress that one sees when progress is going to be long-term. A lot of connections made and commitments made and, you know, long-term goal setting and long-term planning. And we're working on some really compelling projects coming into the winter. I don't remember which ones I can divulge yet.
Well, but, then don't do any of them until you know.
You don't want to get in trouble there.
On the air.
That's right.
So, but I want people to be aware that we have not gone away. We are just taking our time because we know that we don't have to rush, because we truly are the 99%, because honestly, we're 100% of Baltimore City. There are no 1%ers in Baltimore City. The richest Roland Park mansions are not in the 1%. And this is a working class town, and we're going to do this at the pace that Baltimore does things, and just be on the lookout.
All right, Iris. And I thank you so much. I mean, we've covered the Occupy movement from the very beginning and went to New York and produced a video that we put up on the web. And we covered Occupy movements across the country. We'll continue to look at what and bring those different groups together in dialogue.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, the commonalities between, you know, if you sort of look past all this, what to me was kind of some surface issues about, you know, should they be intense? Should they be down there? Are they focused enough? But I tried to listen through for their message, and it wasn't that different. And I think it sort of came together in a kind of a fascinating way with groups that have been working on these issues in the city for a long time. I mean, we, during the election, walked with the people from Build who were saying, hey, why are we just talking about property taxes? Why aren't we talking about kids in neighborhoods? And, you know, the Occupy people were having a kind of a light bulb moment about that, too, and, you know, beginning to realize, you know, sort of where their common cause lay with people in the city. So, you know, I mean, I think that was a worthwhile thing.
And I think that I slowly but surely am becoming a true believer because, I put this whole Occupy movement in this little box in my head where, you know, I try to organize things systematically, and I needed a very clear message. I needed a very clear spokesperson. I needed a very clear leader. I needed a very clear next step. I needed a very clear – and I wasn't getting that, and the frustration was growing. But as I began to talk to and still to this day talk to individuals – about their involvement. The message really does, and when you talk to several individuals, you began to see the commonality of the message and the commonality of the hope. And I think, as the caller said, there was something very different about how this group interacted with not only the Rawlings-Blake administration, but interacted with the police as well as BDC and even some of the financial institutions. I don't give up on me yet. I am hopeful that I can be where I need to be at the moment that I need to be.
Well, can I chime in with one quick thing, which is to, you know, keep reading The Brew, back to it, but because if you're looking for focus, if you're looking for, you know, this feels a little vague to you, we are finding the focus. I mean, there are so many things in this city that, you know, you sort of have a vague sense, this ain't right. Well, after you read The Brew, it's not vague because we look at the numbers, and that's something that, you know, we really feel like we're performing a service. We look at what the spending is. We start to question, you know, how much is the city really kicking in on these tax breaks, pilots, and TIFs, and, you know, start to kind of mentally do the math, you know, look at rec centers, look at, you know, and just start to weigh these things. So we're, you know, we're maybe doing a little service with some of this focus and some of these
numbers. And your other half in terms of The Brew.
it hasn't come to that.
In terms of The Brew, Mark Reuter is one of the finest reporters.
Just incredible.
Investigative reporters anywhere.
He's kicking ass.
And he's good. Let's go back to the phone chair because people are calling in, and I'll give you the status where you go there. There's things out this report that came out about 1 and 2. I just want to give people a sense of these numbers. 97.3 million Americans fall into the low-income category. And together with the 49.1 million who fall below the poverty line and counted as poor, they number 146.4 million people, or 48% of the U.S. population. And that first number of 97, almost 98 million people, are people earning between 100 and 199% of the poverty level and are struggling to make it. That's 48%, 146.4 million people in the United States of America. 410-319-8888. Mike in Hamden, you're on the air.
Hello, Mark, and everybody else. This is Mike McGuire. I've been representing Occupy Baltimore on the show a bunch. And I also love the brew. I'm actually only recently getting to know it, but I found myself agreeing a lot with what Friend was saying, but then also agreeing a lot with what Anthony was saying. When I simultaneously wish that Occupy was doing more and doing better in Baltimore, and that it's probably one of the most important things that's come about. But I wanted to ask Anthony a question. Like, when he said more seriously engaging the issues in Baltimore, I wonder what those are and what he identifies as those issues. Because he might be challenged the same way that we are to come up with exactly what the key things that we need to work on are. But I will say, we've been going at it, my life and the lives of many others have been completely consumed by this. And our focus has been trying to go after issues in Baltimore City that resonate with the broader issues of the Occupy movement, which has to do with equality in society, with how wealth is being distributed, and the role of government in distributing that wealth. So, I mean, we've been working right now. I'm drafting a letter to the Board of Estimates that a bunch of folks are going to sign on to from the Occupy movement about the upcoming vote they have this Wednesday about privatizing some rec centers. We're working constantly on the issue of development and the Baltimore Development Corporation. Today's Monday, so just yesterday, Reverend Dr. Jamal Bryant, the pastor of Empowerment Temple, made a major address in his sermon announcing that he was part of the Occupy movement. That's a 9,000-member church. And I could go on and on. We were out at Franklin Square over the weekend for 4 days in solidarity with the postal workers that are fighting for their jobs. We're working constantly with Good Jobs, Better Baltimore, specifically around the issue of privatization. I can go on endlessly and talk to you about how we're engaging these issues, but I'd like to hear what we're missing.
Well, I think that, not to get too bogged down in it, and I don't want my criticism or my observations to distract you all from the great work that I think that you are doing and certainly the meaningfulness behind what you're doing. But I thought that I would have liked to see, if I could have been part of the team, the strategy team, I would have liked us to be Occupy Baltimore to be a little bit more articulate on issues. And we talk about issues that are in the community, the abandoned homes that are in our city. And what can we do to begin the process of using and not recycling, but repurposing those homes in this city, the city that sees so much homelessness and poverty. I would have liked to, and really I know it's part of the ongoing conversations that are taking place right now. What are we going to do to redistribute the wealth in this city where we do have a very small, almost weak, Mark and I and Fern could sit here and draw up a list of the wealthy people who make the decisions in this city. And they have every elected official in this city that will answer their calls and move whatever project they have along. They control this city. We have to begin not to walk in fear, but to expose that and not to be insulting with it because, people work very hard to earn their wealth and their lifestyle, but to be very honest about who controls this city. And it's not Mayor Rawlings Blake. It's not the president of the city council. It's not members of the legislature. It's those people who contribute to them. Make the decisions of where we go in development, but even worse, how we educate our children and how we begin to find resources to supplement the poor in our city. And those are the kind of things, and maybe I'm a soundbite guy because I was trained as a journalist, but I think that I missed those messages and certainly solutions when it came to my observations of Occupy Baltimore.
Fern, comment before we move next caller?
Yeah. I think by the end that I was hearing that from Occupy, and I respect them for, not leaping into their 10-point, plan right away and in talking about the really big stuff. Mm-hmm. And, they really wanted to do that, and that had... That had a lot of power. And then I respect where they went to by the end, which is sort of evolving into thinking about what the next thing is for them.
And Mark, you put it in perspective for me, because as I looked at what was going on down in that square, I was reminded about what was happening in Cairo, and I was reminded about what was happening in Syria and what was happening in other places around the world. And if nothing else, Time magazine may have gotten it right when they said the occupiers were the
protesters.
What's happening in the city? I mean, you know, we were talking during the break, my first time down there to take a picture on day one of Occupy. You know, in the background of my shot, you can see there's a street person who was just sleeping there in McKeldin Square. That's not, you know, a 22-year-old white kid who, you know, showed up. So anyway, I was happy to see all these issues kind of brought together.
Let's go back to the phones at 410-319-8888. Halim, you're on the air.
Yes. Good evening. How y'all doing?
Welcome. Very well.
Well, I think I might bring a different perspective. And I'm happy that the issue of the poor is being addressed. But it seems to me that it's being addressed in the same manner that it was addressed back in the 60s when Johnson came out with his war on poverty, which I see as just a instrument to maintain poverty and just have people being comfortable in it, as opposed to creating a culture where individuals see that they have power, that they have the ability to rise above their circumstances, not be identified with and by their circumstances, and creating that culture where they take matters into their own hands and come up out of poverty, become a member of the striving poor, and moving into greater assets as opposed to appealing to the government. Because I believe the government has an interest in keeping people dependent. That way that they can get away with their mess.
Hmm. Some thoughts from our two panelists here? I mean, I hear what you're saying, Halim. I'm not one who goes into as a conspiracy theorist, but I do think that I don't know if the government has any interest in keeping people poor, or just a disinterest in dealing with people who are poor and with poverty.
And I think there's an interest, Mark, in keeping people wealthy and maintaining the influence of wealth. And oftentimes we get into this, and people know that I'm a Democrat. I'm very honest about my political leanings, at least. But I also believe that when we look at the traditional parties, it's very difficult to find an inch of difference in them.
I mean, I think that the issue is, in some ways, let's go back to the phones here, but the difference is that it's not so much a disinterest in the government. I don't think the government can answer the questions because of just the power structure that we have. Mm-hmm. And who gets heard and who underwrites what in our country, they don't have the will to make the changes. I mean, we have a economy that is built around finance, an economy that is built around technology that's put a lot of people out of work, and they don't have the answers about how to put people to work. And they're not willing to deal with that issue. And so we're seeing a crisis, I think, in this country and throughout the world. And especially the Western world.
Yeah, the putting people to work thing is kind of the missing piece that, you know, gets forgotten around here. You know, people need jobs. This city needs employers. You know, yes, Anthony's pointing to him.
People need work.
But it's true, you know. I guess I'm feeling Pollyanna-ish today. There's another little sort of peppy good thing that I saw. I hope this translates into, you know, good stuff for the city. Forbes magazine. Baltimore, the second biggest tech city after Seattle.
Maybe the second biggest tech city, and I'll be the opposite of Pollyanna. Is that
all right?
Is that
Jane? You ignorant slut.
You can't hire young kids who live in inner city African American neighborhoods in high tech unless you have the system that trains them. The ability to do it.
Yeah.
It's not playing video games. No. It's showing how to write the algorithms that make the games where the jobs are.
It's the nut we have to crack. It is the nut we have to crack.
Khalik in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Yes.
Welcome.
Good evening.
Good evening.
I don't feel the relevance of Occupy Baltimore to tell the truth. I mean, I can hear all this rhetoric. It sounds, again, like the 60s stuff and like the 70s. After it's all over and after this wave is over, you're going to still have people that are underemployed, and you're going to still have improper relationships between business, business development in the black community. Because that's the real thing, is people, what I see from a black perspective,
yeah,
it's carpetbaggers. I don't see the development of black Baltimore. I'm talking about core black Baltimore being addressed, being made relevant. And where there is a will, there's a way. In other words, the city, that I ain't looking for the city or the government to do a whole lot of employing. They're supposed to be advocates, our representatives. And that means that you advocate to facilitate proper relationships to make sure that big business doesn't run over small business, for instance, that a community can have community-sized businesses, and everything is put in more in perspective so that our children can be hired in these businesses. And and the summer jobs program would be in line. I think if we sit down, as intelligent as people are, we sit down and develop just one thing, a good, solid summer program.
Kelly, I hear you. I think that summer programs are great, but this is my jaundiced view of where we are. What we need to do is put parents to work and adults to work. I want kids to have jobs too. But, I mean, the city has opportunity now to leverage the money they invest in school construction in a bond that will get $1 billion to rebuild our schools. $1 billion if they made it so that people in Baltimore would be hired, put through the union's electricians program, plumbers program, other construction programs to put thousands of people to work in this city. Thousands of men and women getting a decent salary to rebuild Baltimore would do 5 to 10 times the work because it would spread out to their families and would affect 4 or 5 or 6 people each. You know, that's what you have to do. I mean, we have to put people to work in this city, rehabbing the houses. We have to fight for things like letting people put to take solar panels and put them on the roofs of every flat roof in Baltimore, to restart urban agriculture, put people to work. We have 1,000 acres of land in this town, and one estimate I read from one study was, and this may be too high, but it was an interesting estimate, that for every acre, you could put 10 people to work.
Wow.
That's amazing.
And feed the city. So what we need to be doing things that put people back to work.
Well, our little piece of it at The Brew is to try to look at the programs where ostensibly all these things are happening. And are they really happening? And are the programs efficient? Are they going to, our callers kind of has a feel that, the people with influence are skewing the process. Are the programs that really need to be, that really are deserving, the ones that are getting the funding? Or is it, campaign contributors? That's the kind of thing we look at.
We have to take a break. I'm going to thank our guests for being here this hour. Fern Shen, who's publisher and editor of the Baltimore Brew. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Mark.
My dear old friend, Anthony McCarthy, host of the Anthony McCarthy Show every Friday here at 5 p.m.
Great to be here, Mark. Look forward to being with you more.
Yeah.
In the new year.
In the new year, man. The new year's coming.
Yeah, 2012.
We're going to take a trip back and forward with our next guest. Dr. Alondra Nelson wrote a book called Body and Soul, The Black Panther Party and the Fight Against Medical Discrimination. She's a professor of sociology at Columbia University. And it's a fascinating discussion. It's a different look at the Black Panther Party, but also has very deep relevance for 2011-12. So stay with us. We'll be right back.